I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 98 of Season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Curtis Blaze from a whole bunch of different things. Welcome back to the show, Curtis.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be on the show with you.
Minute 98 begins with Welsh continuing to complain and ends with a man crouching by a tree. Yesterday, we ended things with George getting into a fight over something that he did hours ago. Apparently, Mr. Welsh is the local school teacher's husband who didn't like the fact that George, you know, got her to cry. She started crying. And then after he calmed her down, he left to go get a drink. Because apparently it was too much for him to have to be dealing with that. And he continues with his diatribe. I'm going to go back a little bit and just talk about, start the diatribe from what he said yesterday. He goes, "The next time you talk to my wife like that, you'll get worse. She cried for an hour. It isn't enough she slaves teaching your stupid kids how to read and write, and you have to bawl her out." That's what he complains about. He complains about the fact that she's going to teach stupid kids, but then, you know, the fact that he yelled at her, that's what got her upset.
And my wife is a teacher, and some dude calls and bawls out my wife and makes her cry for an hour. I've defended my wife physically before, let's just say. And outside of the heat of the moment, I don't know if I would beat someone up, but I can understand the impulse.
Okay. That's fair. But I think part of the whole thing, again, it goes back to the fact that, you know, he calmed his wife down and then went to go get a drink.
talk more about
that's that. That's the thing that bothers me.
Tell me about that. Why is that bothering you?
No, because, you know, if, again, putting myself in that situation, if my wife was sitting and crying for an hour or whatever the amount of time that she's been crying for because someone, you know, insulted her or said something really bad to her or whatever it is, I don't think I would, you know, calm her down and say, "All right, I'm out of here."
Yeah.
You know, it sounds, you know, I would have to stick around from that perspective. I would want to stick around also, not just have to.
Right.
You want to make sure that your wife is calm and collective and, you know, and moves on, you know, isn't concerned anymore.
When your wife is that upset over something that she cries for an hour, like, your plans are off for the night. You're staying home. You're watching her favorite movie. You're hanging out with her.
And don't forget, this is Christmas Eve. It's not as if,
oh my God,
you know, this is just a random night.
Oh, man, I forgot about that. Yeah. Oh, this guy is just a terrible guy.
There's something wrong here. I mean, again, I think there's too many people in the bar on Christmas Eve. That's a separate issue in Bedford Falls.
I read somewhere, and I don't know what the time frame for this is. I don't know anything about it, but I think I read somewhere, and I'm sorry that I can't confirm it live right now, but I think Christmas Eve wasn't such an important thing back in the day. I think Christmas Eve was just kind of another day, kind of like the day before Thanksgiving, for instance. And then the big day was Christmas for everybody. And this might be on the other side of that line. This movie might be.
Ah, okay. It's very possible.
But I'm sorry, I can't confirm that. I just heard that somewhere.
Right.
So it might be that this is like just like the day before Thanksgiving where everybody's in town, but there's nothing really going on. So everybody goes out to the bar to see who's around.
Right.
Everybody's home from college. Everybody's in so they can be there for it. Probably Martini's biggest.
Right. No, because also Martini's not home with his family. You know, and we know he's got a big family and he's got a goat and he's got a dog and, you know, everything.
And all of the businesses downtown are open when George is crossing the street.
That's right. Okay, so it is very possible that you were correct from that perspective then, that maybe back then things were different on Christmas Eve.
But still, that guy, after calming his wife down, then leaving is just jerky.
That's right.
No matter what night it is.
That's Mr. Welch for you. And then Martini starts screaming at him and goes, "You get out of here, Mr. Welch." And he goes, "Wait, I want to pay for my drink."
I just thought of something too. We'll get back to the pay for the drink. But the fact that Welch says, because remind me, you're married.
Yes.
You know how you and your wife talk about everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he's saying she has
except for movies. She doesn't like talking about movies. She can't understand how I can sit and talk about movies for hours, which is why I have to talk to other people about it. You know, but that's fine.
That makes sense. I think that's everybody's thing that doesn't waste my minutes.
Yes.
So probably that's her complaint too. She's probably the one that calls all of the kids stupid. That's an implication there of what he just said, like, "You and all your stupid kids." Those are definitely words that have also come out of her mouth. And he's just repeating them.
Yes. No, not necessarily.
It's possible. It's not very similar to that at home. Like, "Oh, I got to take care of these stupid kids all day, and then they bawl me out. Oh."
No, I would actually interpret that differently. I would interpret the fact that she comes home and she complains about the kids. I don't think she says they're stupid kids. She says, "Oh, I'm dealing with these kids, and it's so difficult to teach them, and it's so difficult, you know, to get them to close their jackets on the way home when it's cold outside because of a flower." You know, things like that. I think she's complaining, and he's interpreting it, and then he's saying, you know, that you're stupid kids.
Yeah.
I don't think she's saying it. You know, again, I could see that happen. I mean, come on, I come home, I complain about, things that happen at work and stuff like that. And you know, I might say, "Oh, I can't believe that stupid person said this," or whatever it is. You know, so I can understand that, but in this case, I think I wanted to try and defend Mrs. Welch a little bit, you know, that she probably is a good teacher.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm not saying she's,
you know, because I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago. I don't think she did anything wrong, because, you know, if Zuzi opened her coat on the way home, that's not the teacher's fault.
Can you even imagine? That's one of those things you guys probably have this conversation, but it just makes me cringe every time I see that scene. Like, George is completely unreasonable. There's nothing he's saying there that's reasonable. The fact that he's mad at the teacher is just him going off from stress. And it's so embarrassing watching, cringe inducing. Because of course the teacher doesn't control if a kid zips their coat up on the way home. It's ridiculous.
That's right.
He should have.
No, the teacher does control the way that the kid leaves school.
Yeah, but we've all been kids. No way.
Yeah.
There's 0% chance it's that teacher's fault.
Yeah.
George doesn't have a leg to stand on in this argument.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So have you ever been in a situation where you are being unreasonable, perhaps because you're drunk, but not necessarily? You're just high, you're in high spirits, and you're feeling self-righteously angry about something in a situation like this, where you are getting ready to pay for a drink or some food or whatever, and they just want you gone. And they're just, "Don't worry about paying for it. Just get out of here. We'd prefer that." Has that ever been a thing you've done?
I can't think of a situation where I have. Have you?
Similar. It was a party. There was a party where I hadn't contributed to the keg yet. And I ended up in a fight that was kind of my fault, and I was asked to leave instead of, and it didn't matter. I was like, oh, I still got to pay, you know, because you're still trying to, you're trying to save face and you want to pay for the drink. And they're just like, no, we prefer that you leave. That was me as an 18-year-old one time.
Oh, wow.
It is a terrible feeling because I can tell you, at the point that this guy, that Welch says, I want to pay for my drink, he's already feeling remorse for the fact that he acted out in public this unreasonably. He's
I don't think so. I think he just wants to stay and drink more. I think that's his remorse.
Really?
Not the fact that he hit George. I think his remorse is that I don't want to go back home. I want to stay here and keep drinking.
Wow. We are definitely interpreting things differently today.
That's good, isn't it? Isn't it? You know, we want to give diverse opinions on what we think is going on here.
Very true. Very true. Wow. So that's just him trying to make an excuse to stay so he can drink some more.
Yeah.
I'll have to think.
No, a question. Wait, to stay in order to drink more or stay not to go home?
Not to go home.
There's a difference.
I can see that.
You can be nursing a drink for hours. Doesn't matter.
Well, if this place is like my hometown, there's only one other place to go drink, and the other place sucks.
Okay.
Now both of the bartenders that listen to this in town are going to be wondering if I'm talking about their place. Damn it.
No, you're talking about the other place.
There you go. No, I'm talking about the other place. I'm here, aren't I?
That's right.
You get out of here quick for hitting my best friend. Get out.
That's right.
I like Martini.
Right. And then Martini goes, never mind the money. You get out of here quick. All right. You hit my best friend. Get out. Now, I mentioned this, I think, yesterday. It's very interesting that Martini refers to him as his best friend.
I was thinking,
you know, this is George is a businessman. And he's a businessman who helped Martini buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that doesn't make them the best of friends.
I think what happens here is lots and lots of people call George their best friend. Because who else in town helped them defy Potter and buy a house? The dream of home ownership. They don't have to live in Pottersville in their crappy, yucky houses. They have their own warm, personal house that George helped them build. He might not literally mean that George is his best friend, but that is definitely something he might say out loud around George so that George understands how warmly he feels towards him. More of a less of an expression of an expression of affection, just saying it that way, expresses everything he means without going into a big long paragraph about what he really means.
That's actually very interesting. Okay, I didn't think about that from that perspective. I don't just refer to some guy that helped me as my best friend. I mean, you'd have more to it.
Oh, okay. That dovetails right into what I was going to say. Also, English is his second language, so he might use phrases like very best friends or best friends interchangeably with just I like this guy, just because he doesn't know all the nuances of English. And best friend might just be the best way to say that, to convey what he means without having, you know, all of the English words to be able to do that.
Ah, you're saying that he's saying best friend instead of just saying friend, good friend?
Something like that. You know, it's Sala, who also English isn't his first language, going, my very best friend, Indy! Something like that. Just an enthusiastic expression of friendship for someone who doesn't know all of the English words to be nuanced. But also, I get the feeling there's a lot. I mean, that's the point of this movie, is that there's just a lot of affection for George from everybody. Everybody loves George Bailey.
Not everybody. Except for Potter, exactly.
I bet even his bodyguard is like, you know, that George isn't too bad of a guy, but job's a job.
Yeah, I guess people don't have anything bad to say about it. So the only people who don't like George are Potter and Mr. Welsh.
And probably even Mr. Welsh, I bet, regrets it in the morning when he wakes up in the fine house that George helped him buy.
Very possibly.
And the language of this movie also says the same thing, because everybody in the entire bar is trying to get a hand on George to help him stand up and to help him out.
That's right. And then Nick comes over to George and goes, "You all right, George?" And then George, "Who was that?" "He's gone. No worry. His name is Welch. He no coming to my place no more." "Oh, Welch. Ah, that's what I get for praying."
Right. That's such a Jimmy.
You know, I think George is misinterpreting it too.
That's such a Jimmy Stewart thing to say, though. He always plays such a crusty guy that way.
Yeah.
Nothing ever goes right for him. Not in any of the Alfred Hitchcock movies, not in any of the movies. He's always kind of that guy. Like, that's what I get.
That's right. And then Martini goes, "The last time he come in here, you hear that, Nick?" "Yes, you bet." And then George looks around and goes, "Oh, where's my insurance policy?" "Oh, here it is." And then Martini starts pleading with him. "Oh, no, please don't go this way, Mr. Bailey." "I'm all right." "No, no, you feel no good. Sit down and rest." "I'm all right. Please no go away. Please." Now, I'm very confused. Why is Martini pleading with George? You know, is it does he recognize that that's the insurance policy and that George is going to be doing something drastic at this point?
Maybe.
Like, why is he telling him? I don't know. That doesn't make sense. No. Unless George would have. I don't think George would have said something to him.
I think it's more this. That could be a thing, and that could be one of the layers of what's happening here. But I think really it's just a realistic depiction of the business owner. This guy who is important, an important guy in the town, just got punched out in your business. You want to make a show of taking care of that guy. No matter what else, you don't want him to leave with his last impression of your business being the place where he got punched out. You want to take care of him. You want to sit him down, want to give him a few drinks, maybe a free plate of spaghetti. I don't know what time it is. I think I could go for spaghetti any time of the day, honestly. And just take care of him a little bit. No, don't go away. Don't go away. You know, at first Nick and Martini were trying to get him to leave because they didn't want him to embarrass himself, you know, crying in public and everything and carrying on. He was obviously very distraught. Now that he's got the sympathy of everybody and just got punched out, they want to just take care of him, I think. I think it's just as simple as that. Maybe call his wife.
Okay.
Get her to come over.
Okay. That's fair. It's very strange, you know, that it happens right after he says, you know, "Where do I have my insurance policy?"
I know.
But well, so when Martini says "don't go this way," could he be referring to, you know, you shouldn't leave through the front door? You shouldn't leave through the back door? You shouldn't go and commit suicide? Like, what does it mean, "don't go this way"?
Well, I think there's something else going on here too, because it's got to be dialogue that works to make the story work. But I think also it's symbolic dialogue too. As the audience, we're picking up on "don't go this way." We're starting to sense suicide. He's talking about his insurance policy. Potter said he'd be better off if he didn't exist anymore, if he died, whatever that line was. They'd be better off without you than they are with you. We're starting to sense that. And the dialogue is kind of leaning that way too. Even if it's not literally supposed to mean that Martini knows he's feeling suicidal, we as viewers understand that he is, and that dialogue feeds into it while also serving the whole, you know, the actual literal story, if that makes sense. That's what I think.
Yeah.
I think it's the old time movie geniuses symbolically telling us things subconsciously.
Okay. That's fair. And, you know, they're trying to keep George in, but George still leaves. You know, he's out of there.
Right. The forces of good aren't going to win this one. He's going to need supernatural assistance.
That's right. And then we get the swipe that goes back. I mean, you talked earlier in the week about the swipe going from right to left. This time the swipe goes from left to right.
Right. They just, the language of film telling us that now he's going back home.
That's right. That's right. And then we see a car coming down the street. The car's slipping and sliding. And then he makes a turn. And as he makes the turn, he goes right into a tree.
Okay. I'm putting on my boxing gloves. We did a little pre-talk about this.
Before you get there, I want to talk about one thing before you get there. Did you notice that before the car hits the tree, it doesn't have any snow on it, but then when we see it's hit the tree, there's like tons of snow on the front of the car.
Yeah.
On the bumpers and stuff like that.
That's like kind of a famous goober on the scene. Did you notice? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you notice how gross and slimy the snow is after it hits?
Yes. Oh, I did.
Disgusting. Like, oh, for sure, that is AFFF firefighting foam.
Oops. That's right. Right. I mean, again, the whole slipping and sliding is like that. Yes. Okay. So now you can go back to where you were, what you were wanting to start saying before.
Okay. If you are just in the snow and you're not drunk, you're slowly navigating your way down the street, right? Aren't you? You're not a jerk and swerving from side to side and barely able to stay on the road. We had this discussion, I think maybe in the last minute, where you don't think he's drunk and I think he is. And this is the reason I think he's drunk, because this looks like a classic drunk driving. He's back and forth coming down the road and then boofs the turn and hits the tree. And then not only that, but gets out all mad that he hit the tree instead of going, oh my God, I hit a tree, all soberly. So that's my argument for drunk. You're saying what? What's your side of it?
I'm saying that he's not drunk. He's just distraught.
Okay.
George is, he's trying to figure out how he's going to get himself out of this mess. So, I mean, that's the way I see it.
Okay. Well, that is our disagree. I think the drunkenness contributes to the thoughts of suicide that maybe he wouldn't have considered if he were sober. But we are getting way ahead of ourselves on the minutes there on that one.
Yeah, that's true. But again, I don't think he's drunk. I think he's so out of it right now. And that's what's causing the problems. That's my interpretation of it.
Well, and here again, language of cinema. We have the, we follow the car with a pan, a fancy pan. We've got a nicely framed shot of the road and the car, and then we pan with the car as he crashes into the tree. And that shot, he for real hits that tree. Now, I'm not saying the actor Jimmy Stewart is behind the wheel and runs into a tree, but
no, whoever's driving the car,
there is a person in there. That isn't a dummy. And they really hit that tree. I mean,
yep.
I don't know if they have like a mattress in front of them or what they're doing in order to save themselves from hitting the steering wheel, but damn, that's a quick stop. That's an instant stop going pretty fast.
Definitely true. I mean, come on, people do a lot more dangerous stunts these days than they did back then.
Yeah, but back then they didn't have any science behind it. They were just like, who wants to be the one driving the car? And then a gaffer says, I'll do it. What kind of protection can you
get? More or less.
I don't know. A mattress?
Sounds good to me. How about a seatbelt?
I didn't even have seatbelts. Those cars didn't.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But then also, that's another thing that amazes me about this. They for real hit, that has to be a real tree. That's all there is to it. I mean, they didn't build a fake tree that could withstand that. So they hit a tree and stop instantly, and the car is fine. I mean, in the shot, the car is fine. The car doesn't crumple up. Man, cars were just made out of just battleship steel back then. My car would be destroyed at that speed hitting a tree.
Yeah, mine too. George then gets out of the car. But, you know, it's very funny if you watch, because he tries to close the door and isn't able to.
That door.
You know, before he had trouble opening it, and now he has trouble closing it.
Yep. He's kicking that thing. He kicks it like four times.
Yeah.
Kind of unhinged a little bit. I'm not saying drunk. I'm just saying. Have you noticed the, I watching the Amazon version, there was a blooper thing on the side. Did you see how the car hits the tree head on and then it's sitting beside it for the rest of the scene, shot?
Yes.
Yeah. Fun times.
Yeah, well, it's the way it is. And then someone comes out of the house that's nearby, carrying an umbrella, which I think is really funny that in this type of winter storm, someone is trying to use an umbrella. Blown away the way that Mary Poppins, flies with her umbrella.
I think that actor, though, and I don't know what his name is, I bet he was happy. He's like, oh, thank God, I'm going to be the only one not eating soap today.
Well, tomorrow we'll talk about who it is. I'll leave that for tomorrow. Even though he has one little line at the end of this minute. He says, "What do you think you're doing?" That's all he says. And then he looks down and crouches at the tree and starts looking at it.
Checking out the damage.
That's right. We'll have to find out tomorrow the rest of that conversation.
How did he get out of the house dressed with an umbrella so quickly?
No, I'm not concerned about that. Because is he dressed? He's wearing a suit. He's not wearing, he doesn't look like he's in something that's more appropriate for winter. He heard a car hit his tree, grabbed the umbrella that's sitting in the foyer, opens it up,
That's fair.
runs outside. Yeah. So, but if you look at the snow on the umbrella, you can see it's how soapy it is.
Right.
Going back to what you were talking about, that's just so weird.
It just blows
It
that
reminds me of
snowball.
like the pictures from the Cat in the Hat, with the way that the snow looks there also. It looks very soapy.
Oh yeah, it does, doesn't it? I never thought about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe they copied it from It's a Wonderful Life. They had Frank Capra doing the shot,
Dr. Seuss was the Frank Capra fan.
That maybe. You never know. All right. So every Tuesday, we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Inspirational Story Edition, where my guest will give some sort of adventure, misadventure, anecdote, story, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that they found to be inspirational to them. So, Curtis, you have a story for us?
I guess I do. I don't know if my life is inspirational, but I'll give it a shot. My inspiration, I guess the lesson I learned from this. Maybe I'll just tell it that way. I was out on this. I was like 20, 21. I was a kid, and I was out on this mountain on in Arkansas. Do you know Arkansas? How that is
In
here?
general,
Mountain, but
I've never been in Arkansas.
it's the South in America. It's this mountainy, gross place. I mean, I think it's gross, but whatever. It's also very pretty, so I'm out on this mountain in Arkansas, and there's this retired teacher. I don't know her name. She bought this mountain, and she had like a shack on top of this mountain. And by shack, I mean it was she had a like a place for her bed and a place for her couch and kind of a kitchen and kind of a greenhouse. And like a big cistern to collect water, and a couple of outbuildings, one of them being an outhouse, I assume, and places for chickens and stuff. And this woman had 50 dogs, and she was gross. She was like, probably didn't bathe, because the only water she has is whatever rainwater she collects. And the whole scene was disgusting. Just, ugh, it was so gross. And I was hired to come up and help this guy build a like a I don't know like an addition to this house, and this addition would be a toilet, and the toilet was going to work on it was going to use a gallon or whatever of the cistern water that's collected in order to help it flush, right? I don't know if you're aware of this, but you can just dump a bucket into a toilet and that'll make it flush.
Yes,
I don't
I'm
know
aware.
where
I
it's going to
actually am
go.
aware of it.
Okay. So probably my guess, because I didn't see the end of the construction, my guess would be that this toilet would have a hole that goes out the side and then, I don't know, runs down the mountain. I don't know. But the whole thing was gross. So I get up there to start building, and this guy who's the contractor, he's obviously not a carpenter. He just is a guy who's doing something nice for this teacher. And for all I know, his teacher was one of his old teachers, something like that. And so we've got to build this addition. And for a foundation, all we're doing is taking rocks that we find. I mean, we're literally just scouting around for rocks and putting rocks on the ground underneath, like, the wood. Because this thing's, like, you know, a foot and a half in the air. And all we're doing is piling up rocks to make a foundation for this thing. And I can tell you, this is not going to work as a foundation. It's just not. It would have been better to put poles down and dig them down until we hit bedrock or something. But that's not what we were doing. We were just stacking rocks. And the worst part is, it's raining the whole time. I mean, just pouring. And it's summer. And it's Arkansas. So it's hot. And it's gross. And it's raining. And there's 50 dogs on this property. And, for all I know, there's 70. There might have only been 35. But there's a lot of dogs. And I'm pretty sure the mud isn't just mud, if you know what I'm saying. Ooh. I'm pretty sure the mud that we're squelching around in is dog poop. So we're putting these rocks down that I just know as someone who's kind of a builder isn't going to last very long. Just a big disaster waiting to happen. And the reason I'm doing this all is because there is a hot redhead waiting for me in Wisconsin. And I don't have any money. I mean, I am broke. At this point in my life, I'm just a guy who's driving around the country, experiencing life, not being employed, just kind of going from, it's the early days of the internet. So I'm meeting women on the internet, just kind of going hang out with them for a little while and kind of moving on. Just a rambling guy, you know? And this guy has promised me $100 if for 2 days I help him like put together the bottom of this thing so that it, you know, stays together for a while. So that's what I'm doing. So I get there, I'm immediately frustrated with this guy. He's terrible. I'm not getting along with him. He's a cigar smoker on top of the just dog dander in the air, which you can see. It's like breathing oil and dog smell and taste. And everything about this is just gross. And I find myself wanting to argue with him all the time because everything he's doing is the opposite of how you should build something. But then I'm just like, oh, I just get myself to a place where I just become like I engage my enthusiastic worker mode. And I'm afraid of dogs, but I let that wash over me. I just become Mr. Positive to this guy. I just do whatever he says enthusiastically, immediately, and absolutely no arguments or misgivings about it. Just so I can get my $100 so I can go to Wisconsin to get with this girl. And I guess the profound lesson that I learned from this thing is that if the goal's worth it, you just push through. If the journey might be muddy, dog-filled, gross chaos, but the destination, that's the jackpot. And you just have to put up with life sometimes. And just the only way out is through. Just get your $100 and move on to the next thing. I don't know how inspiring that is, but that's the story.
Okay. I think it's good. I think you did a great job with that. All right. So, Curtis, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Curtis Blaze?
Okay. If you know how Linktree works, you go to Linktree/Curtis Blaze. My last name is spelled BLOES, like blows. That's how you find everything. All my podcasts that I've been on. It's all my Instagram, Facebook, photography, everything.
All right. Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.